Numbers 16:1 through 16:35, the sixth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on November 28, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
And so the question is, how is this word being used differently? Because if sin is a rebelliousness within the heart, within the soul, then how can one have an intentional sin? And there we're talking about acts that are in violation of the commandments that God has given, although the person who does it is unaware that they are violating that commandment. And yet sin is used to refer to that. I think that the best way to understand this, and this is stuff that's coming together for me, and I'm still in the process of sorting it all out. But I have been struck, as I've been going through Numbers, with the analogy between what is happening in Numbers and what happens with a parent and a small child. That is to say, that when you have a small child as a parent, you lay down the law. And there are certain things that are permissible. There are other things that just are not to be tolerated, certain kinds of actions. And one needs to punish for those consistently. Why do you do it that way? I think there are several reasons. One is establishing authority. I, as a parent, am the one who am, I am determined to be the law enforcer here. And you need to recognize me as the one who has authority to do that. Secondly, to indicate a sense of seriousness, I take looking, controlling your behavior, I take that seriously. That is, it's my job to discipline you, and I'm going to do that. But thirdly, it's establishing certain behaviors that ultimately are related to a set of values. As a parent, you're primarily interested in passing on values, but a child isn't ready to receive just values. A child has to grow up into values. So you don't start with values, you start with behaviors. And then as they become more mature, and are able to understand those values and internalize those values, then the strict behaviors become less important. That is, they don't have to be enforced. If you take something as simple as don't cross the street by yourself, that's something that is strictly enforced when the child is young. But as the child grows in understanding and maturity, they understand all of the implications, all the things to look out for and how important it is. And at a certain point, you don't enforce that anymore. It's not necessary. The child has internalized the things that need to be internalized. By analogy, I think God is doing the same kind of thing. He's not dealing with children, but he is dealing with a culture that's in formation. And since he's dealing with a culture that's in formation, he begins by laying down the law, literally. That he establishes these commands and he enforces them strictly. He's establishing the fact that he is in authority. He's establishing the fact that he's serious about these commandments. He wasn't just joking. He meant these commandments. And these commandments have built within them a set of values that God wants the culture the society to internalize. So I think at this point in Israel's history, to violate a commandment, no matter how trivial or for whatever reason, God seems to be determined to punish if for those violations. As we see later on, there are times we see in David's life where he is fleeing for his life, as I recall, and he and his men take the showbread, which is not permissible to David and his men, but he needs it in order for them to survive. And Jesus refers to that incident and uses that incident as evidence that God wants loyalty to him rather than sacrifice, rather than the letter of the law. So I think we see in the history of Israel that God's perspective was always that he was interested in the condition of the heart, but at this early stage, he's also going to enforce the letter of the law. And so an unintentional sin is a violation of the letter of the law. It's forgiven, and there are provisions for it, but they have to go through a ceremony in order to recognize that they did indeed violate the commandment that was given, even though it was not intentional. Okay, so I think the underlying sense behind sin has not changed, but in that time and the way that God was relating to Israel, you could the notion of an unintentional sin made sense. We can talk about that more in the questions afterwards if you want. Okay, chapter 16, Korah's Rebellion. Now in Korah's Rebellion, this is an event that occurred in the time in which the Israelites are wandering in the wilderness for the 40 years. As I've mentioned before, there's very little of those 40 years that made their way into Numbers. And this is just one of them. There are a few more chapters that seem to fit into that pattern as well. But very soon in Numbers, in the narrative in Numbers, the Israelites are going to start moving to position themselves to enter into the Promised Land. And when that happens, we're getting towards the end of the 40 years. So there isn't much of Numbers that's devoted to that 40-year period. When does this event with Korah occur? There are no clues, there are no hints in it of any significance. My suspicion is that this happens towards the end of the 40 years. And I'm only suspecting that because I think we have to give them time to forget some of the lessons that they should have learned as they were progressing from Egypt to the Promised Land. And their refusal to go into the Promised Land. But that's all I'm basing it on. It could have been any time in the 40 years. But in the narrative in Numbers, this is the first of a series of incidents in which, once again, we will see the rebelliousness of the people of Israel. And in these incidents, God takes strong action in response to them. And we are going to see thousands of Israelites die as a result of God's punishment for this disobedience. So in these 40 years, when that whole generation died off, surely some of them died of natural causes, but quite a number of them died as a result of God's punishment for acts of disobedience, as we'll see in this case. Okay, the first section, verses 1 through 3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Okay, we've got a rebellion on our hands. There are people are rising up against the rule, the leadership of Moses and Aaron. And what we'll see later on is it's primarily Aaron that's in the sights of this rebellion. The leaders of this rebellion are Korah, and Korah is a Levite. Then Dathan, Abiram, and On. Now, it's unclear what role On has to play in this. This is the only mention of his name in the entire account. So it's not clear the extent of his participation in this. But these three are all from the tribe of Reuben. And the people of Israel, as they progressed on their march through the desert, they had their positions when they camped were strictly laid out. So every time they would stop and set up their tents, they set them up in a specific place. It was all organized. In the middle was the tent of meeting. On three sides of the tent of meeting, there were different branches of the tribe of Levi. And on the fourth side were the priests, Aaron and the descendants of Aaron. Then arrayed around them are the other tribes of Israel. Well, as it works out, Korah and his tribe were just to the south of the tent of meeting. And Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, was just south of Korah's tribe. So they would have been camped side by side. So it would appear then, every time they're camping, their Korah and these Reubenites are exchanging information and assessing what's going on. And as a result, they become united in their discontent with the leadership of Moses and Aaron. So those are the leaders, those are the names that are mentioned, but it's not just those men. In addition to them, there are 250 prominent members of Israelite society. It says that they are, leaders of the congregation, which means prominent people in the society, chosen in the assembly, and that's difficult because it's not clear what the assembly is. This word is used in related languages to mean the group of people that counsel with the king. We don't have mention of such a formalized body in the Pentateuch. But presumably, these are people with whom Moses counseled when he was making decisions. Men of renown, people with good reputations. So this is not a group of nobodies that are rising up. This is the cream of the society that is rising up against Moses and Aaron. What is it? I want to point out one other thing. In verse 1, it says that these leaders, that is Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, my translation says, took action. But action is in italics because action is not in the Hebrew. All it says is they took. In Hebrew, the verb to take is a transitive verb. That is, it's a verb that you expect to hear an object with. You take something. If you said Fred took, your immediate response is took what? That's not a complete sentence. Similarly, in Hebrew, it is not a complete sentence to say that they took. So that's why action was supplied here, because it's not stated explicitly, and the translators assumed that that was the appropriate thing to substitute in here. It is possible that that word in the Hebrew is mispointed. That is, that not they didn't put the right vowels in. Now, in Hebrew, you've got the consonants as letters, and the vowels are indicated by little dots and other little marks. These same consonants could represent a different word, and that would mean became arrogant. So if you just change a couple of the vowels, this could be became arrogant, in which case you wouldn't need an object. It seems to me in the context that's highly likely. But what is really meant here is that these men became arrogant. And we'll see later on that there is an arrogance involved here. All right, what is their charge? What is their accusation? Their accusation is that Moses and Aaron have gone too far, that the next statement is that all the Israelites are holy and God is with them. And then they go on to say, you have exalted yourselves above everyone else. Now, as we look through the rest of the passage, this appears to be a challenge to Moses or Aaron's position as priest. They want the priesthood to be more widely spread. That is to say, the prerogative of the priest is to enter into the presence of God. The prerogative of the priest is to have direct contact with God, direct access to God. They want that access to be spread more broadly. And Moses is being attacked because he is the ally of Aaron that keeps Aaron in his position, that is able to keep Aaron in his position. So it's the two of them that the people are taking on, and they're questioning this monopoly on the priestly prerogatives and want it to be spread more broadly. They say, enough, we've had it, you've gone too far. In other words, they're saying, you've gone beyond your mandate. You have extended your power beyond what is legitimate. And we want to correct that. We want to bring it back into line. Their claim, all Israelites are holy. There's a sense in which that's true. There's a sense in which the Israelites have been set aside. They are a special people through whom God is going to do a unique thing. In that sense, they are holy. And we notice in chapter 15, there was what God said to Moses when he instructed them to wear the tassels. He says in verse 40 of that chapter, in order that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your God. So just in the previous chapter that had been touched upon. So they are claiming we are all holy. And if we are all holy, then ought we not all have access to God? And there ought not be these priestly prerogatives reserved for just one family. And they argue the Lord is in our midst. And so those prerogatives ought not be reserved for just one family. In Exodus 29:45, God had said when he was talking about the establishment of the tent of meeting, he had said, and I will dwell among the sons of Israel and will be their God. And his presence among them was represented by the ark that was in the tabernacle. So they're claiming God is right here with us. We ought to have, there ought not be this separate class that has special prerogatives that is only given to Aaron and his family. So, they extend from that, you, Aaron and Moses, have exalted yourselves into a position that you ought not have. It's not legitimate. You have powers and prerogatives. You have taken upon yourself powers and prerogatives that ought not be exclusively yours. This is a wonderful little challenge. It is so democratic. And it's interesting to me that you would have a democratic appeal in such an ancient time. I think of a democratic appeal as being a more modern phenomenon, but obviously it's not a fully modern phenomenon. But this is the appeal of revolutionaries throughout the ages, and that is that the masses have been abused. The masses have been taken advantage of, and in the name of the masses, we will overthrow the existing power. The way that this is stated is very clever, and it is interesting to me because in Gutenberg, I recently read the Phaedrus, a dialogue by Plato, in which the point of the whole dialogue is that there is an important distinction to be made between two kinds of verbal exchanges. One is rhetoric, and the other is what he calls dialectic. Rhetoric is used to win people over, but it's used to win people over by fogging the issues. You win people over by using words ambiguously, using words without making proper distinctions. And by doing that, you can make a compelling argument, albeit sloppy. You can make an argument that nevertheless gets traction with people. Dialectic, on the other hand, is clarifying. It's a way of speaking that makes issues more distinct, more clear, such that people can look at them in all their clarity and make an assessment or make a judgment. And it appears to me that this is what Plato would call rhetoric, because there's a sense in which the Israelites are holy. That is true. But that doesn't mean that there ought not be, that there cannot be within Israelite society people set aside for the priesthood. They are holy in the sense that they are a society set apart for a particular use by God. But just because they're holy in that sense doesn't mean that they qualify for every use by God. And that's a distinction that's being blurred by the rebels rather than clarified. It is also true that God is among them, in a sense, but God has a special relationship with some of them, and in particular Moses, as has been pointed out earlier in Numbers. God indicated that Moses is unique because he speaks to Moses like person to person, the way that we talk one to another, and that's unique. He doesn't do that with other people. So these rebels are blurring distinctions that need to be made and drawing conclusions that do not necessarily follow from the arguments that they're making. Obviously, this complaint was constructed to appeal to the broadest segment of Israeli society, and that's the genius of all great revolutions. It has been my observation that the easiest way to unite people is in opposition to something. It's much harder to unite people in favor of something. Everyone can be aroused into opposition. And that's the strategy that's being employed here. So Moses responds to this. Next section, 4 through 11. When Moses heard this, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning, The Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself. Do this. Take censers for yourself, Korah, and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi. I'll stop there for now. So Moses once again falls on his face, and we've seen this before. This is his response in times. It's hard to know exactly what is meant by this action that he takes, but he's done it several times. And it seems to be in a context in which he's in the presence of someone who has said or done something outrageous with respect to God, blasphemous with respect to God. In any case, he falls on his face once again. Then he speaks to Korah and this group of rebels. And he says there's going to be a test tomorrow. I want you and all your friends to get a little container in which incense is burned. Bring your censer, and you will burn incense before God. Now, this is significant because it is the prerogative of priests and priests alone to burn incense to God. And in fact, there was an incident on the way from, or probably while they were at Sinai, it's recorded in Leviticus chapter 10, there's an incident in which two of the sons of Aaron, so they are of the priestly family, they burned incense to God, but in a way that was unauthorized, and it's not clear what it means. It says strange fire. So there was something about what they did that was unauthorized. And God's response to that was that they were consumed by the fire. They were burned up. So they know that there is a death penalty attached to the inappropriate burning of incense to God. So this test is significant. He tells them tomorrow, so he's giving them time to consecrate themselves. They can go wash up, wash their clothes, and prepare themselves to come into the presence of God. And they are to come with these censers to burn incense to God. And he says, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself. It is God who will choose who will be his priests. That's the ultimate determiner of who is to serve the priestly function. It's not man. And he will indicate his choice. And then Moses concludes by saying, you have gone far enough, turning back the phrase that they had used with respect to him. It's you that have overstepped your boundaries. Next section, 8 through 11. Then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation, to minister to them, and that he has brought you near Korah and all your brothers, sons of Levi, with you? And are you seeking for the priesthood also? Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? What Moses is doing here is he has sensed that this is not a united front. Korah in his rebelliousness is motivated by one thing. Dathan and Abiram are motivated by a very different thing. They're united against, but they have different causes. Korah is a Levite. And as a Levite, they are charged with doing the various work that have to do with the tabernacle and the sacrifices and the functions of the religious functions of the priests and the tabernacle. So, for instance, they gather wood for the sacrifices. They carry water for various things. They carry the tent, the tabernacle. They set it up. So they do a lot of the work that has to be done in order for the priests and the tabernacle to function. And within the Levites, Korah has a privileged position. His responsibilities are more significant in some ways than some of the other Levites. But apparently his complaint is, I should be a priest. By all rights, I should be a priest. And apparently part of his concern, or part of the basis of his complaint, is that Korah is the oldest son of the second born to Korath. Moses, Aaron, and Miriam are all born to the oldest son of Korah. I think I'm getting that right, of Korath. So, what's happened is the oldest son and his descendants, they have acquired all of the positions of prestige, and no positions of prestige have gone to the second oldest son. And apparently Korah is seeing an injustice in that. That's according to the rabbis. That's not in here. Whatever is motivating him or justifying his actions in his mind, he seems to want the priesthood. He's jealous of Aaron's position and can't see why Aaron should have that position rather than him. And that's motivating his rebelliousness. That what's interesting here is Moses is reinforcing the idea that Korah actually does enjoy a privileged position. He is a Levite. And that means that he makes the tabernacle's operations possible. And that's actually a very privileged position. It may be the case that Israelite society didn't see it as a privileged position, but it is in fact. Because he is able, through his service, to make the worship of God possible. I mean, it's a lot like around here. It's not a lot like around here, but it is the closest thing to around here, is things like making coffee every week and setting up tables and the PA system and all that sort of thing. That there's a sense in which that is making this possible. And in that sense, it is a service that is very valuable to God and is therefore something that is worthy. Whether it receives the recognition from us that it deserves, that's another issue. It is something that is of great value. Okay, so that's what he has to say to Korah, addressing Korah's specific motivations. In the next section, then, he turns to Dathan and Abiram, who have a different set of issues. Verse 12, then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, we will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey, to have us die in the wilderness? But you would also lord it over us. Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? we will not come up. It's hard to reconstruct exactly who is where and how this is all happening. But it appears to me that Dathan and Abiram may not have been actually present when this group comes to challenge Moses. They're behind it, but they are not actually present. They've stayed back. Now, that may or may not be right. But in any case, Moses addresses them. It says he sent a summons to them. And then we hear their response, and their response is dripping with bitterness and sarcasm. It is really a nasty response. It says, "Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness?" In other words, you took us out of the good place. You took us out of the place that could be characterized as flowing with milk and honey. And we are in the desert where we are going to die. Furthermore, he says, "But you would also lord it over us." Not only did you bring us out here to die, but you take advantage of your position. And you constantly are reaping the benefits from that illegitimately. One is tempted to think back to the time when Moses was still in Egypt. If you'll recall, he confronted a Hebrew who was fighting with another Hebrew, and he broke up the fight. And one of them responded to him. One of them knew that Moses had killed an Egyptian overseer earlier, and responds to Moses saying, "Who made you the Lord and judge over us?" And hints at his knowledge of what Moses had done. But from way back at the beginning, there were challenges to Moses' authority. And this is a similar kind of challenge at a much later date, after much water has gone under the bridge, and nevertheless the same charge is leveled. Then they go on to say, "Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. So the promises that you have made, none of them have been fulfilled. Would you put out the eyes of these men?" That appears to be a saying that would be the equivalent of you pull the wool over somebody's eyes. In other words, would you deceive? You're just deceiving people. We understand what's really going on. We're savvy. But you're just fooling everybody else about this land of milk and honey that we're headed for, and this inheritance of fields and vineyards. You're just leading us on. You aren't really going to come through. So then they say, "We will not come up." It's outright defiance here of Moses. They will not appear before him. Moses' response, verse 15, "Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, 'Do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them.' And Moses said to Korah, 'You and all your company be present before the Lord tomorrow, both you and they along with Aaron. And each of you will take his fire pan and put incense on it, and each of you will bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan.'" So Moses is furious. And I think he's furious not so much out of being personally attacked, but he is furious because of the outright rebelliousness that they are expressing towards God himself. This is defiance in the face of God. And I think Moses understands it that way. So he says, "Do not regard their offering." Now, there's no offering mentioned in this passage, so it's not clear what that means. But this term can be used in a very generic sense of all kinds of offerings and sacrifices. And presumably that's what he has in mind here. In other words, do not allow them into your presence. Do not regard any of their attempts to approach you and to get forgiveness. Let their sins rest on them, I think is what he's saying. Then he defends himself, I have not taken a single donkey from them. And this appears to be a saying as well. I haven't touched them. I haven't done anything to harm them. They have no basis for their bitterness and their rebellion. In other words, Moses is saying, I have not been corrupt. So then he repeats to Korah what will happen on the next day, what the test will consist of. They are all to bring their censers and appear before God. Aaron will do the same, and we'll let God decide this issue. Okay, the next day, verse 18. So they each took his own censer and put fire on it and laid incense on it, and they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Thus Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly. But they fell on their faces and said, O God, thou God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, wilt thou be angry with the entire congregation? Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So they all appear. Korah shows up not just with the other co-conspirators, but he brings the whole congregation, that is, people from all over the Israelite camp. So we have a large gathering of people here, and we have a mixture of rebels and non-rebels, presumably. And as they're gathered, God says to Moses and Aaron, step back, and I'll just wipe them out. We've seen this kind of statement from God before. And again, I don't think this is a serious proposal on the part of God. It's just another time in which God is encouraging Moses to see things through the perspective of God and to kind of step back and look at it and assess it and what would be consistent with God's values as he knows them. And again, Moses falls on his face. And what he asks is that you, God, the creator and master of the entire universe, if one man sins, you don't wipe out everybody. That's not the way you do things. So he encourages God, don't wipe everybody out. Just bring your judgment on the guilty. So God says, okay, then get back from the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, the leaders of this rebellion. The next section. Then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing that belongs to them, lest you be swept away in all their sin. So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. And Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. For if these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. So we've got a large group of people gathered around the tents of these rebels. And Moses tells everyone to stand back. Don't touch them and get away, because God is going to come in judgment on these men. And it's not going to be my doing. God's going to do it in a way that it will be clear that it's not my doing, that it's his doing. And what will happen is there will be a new thing. There'll be something that will happen that will be entirely different. The ground is going to open up like a mouth, and it's going to swallow them. It's important here that it be obvious that it's God's doing and not Moses. Because the issue here is does Moses have authority from God to do what he is doing? And if they die like normal men die, then Moses does not have that stamp of approval from God. And the next section. Then it came about, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, "The earth may swallow us up." Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. So God is acting dramatically here. This is clearly God doing it and not Moses. The earth opens up. These men and their entire households fall down into the crack in the ground, and then the ground closes up on them. And in addition, the 250 men who with their censers are all consumed by fire, just as had been the sons of Aaron, who had offered strange fire in Leviticus chapter 10. Okay. In this section of Numbers, the rebelliousness of Israel becomes almost monotonous. I mean, you see the same kinds of things happening over and over. And I will warn you, we will see the same kinds of things happen again in the next few chapters. It does not abate. This is a generation that was rebellious from the beginning and continues to be rebellious. And God has determined that this generation will completely die out before they enter into the promised land. They are always wishing that they could go back to Egypt where things were wonderful. And this generation has to completely die before Israel is ready to enter into the promised land. The only thing that's new in this section is we see a little bit of the political maneuverings that are happening behind the scenes and some of the motivations that are behind people's rebelliousness. And that is interesting. There is a self-serving aspect to the people that are leading some of this rebelliousness. One of the questions that I thought about as I was looking at this is how could they have done this? How could they have questioned whether Moses was rightfully in his place of leadership over Israel and whether Aaron was rightly in his place? It seems to me that there has been abundant evidence of that. But it's important to realize that the nature of the text that we are reading, and that is we've got incidences that have been selected out of a long period of time. And there's a lot of the mundane that occurs between the incidents, the individual incidents. If we put ourselves in their shoes, there's a lot of just day-to-day things not going well. There's the sand in our soup. There's the hot sun. There's the wind blowing. There are all kinds of things that are happening on the day-to-day. On the day-to-day, the reminders that they have of God's presence are the manna, the cloud and the pillar of fire, and an occasional miracle or sign that happens. But those are on rare occasions. And the manna and the cloud are easy to take for granted. On a day-to-day basis, God's presence outside of those things is not apparent. God dealt directly with Moses. He spoke to him as man to man. But he didn't speak to the people as man to man. So Moses he comes to the people saying, God said X. But generally speaking, they haven't heard God say X. So there's that possibility for them to question whether Moses is doing things on the up and up. Is he trustworthy? Does he have our best interests in mind? Or is he doing what I would like to do, and that is take his position and use it to his own advantage? It's easy, I think, for people to talk themselves out of getting focused on the mundane and the problems of the present, and I've talked about this before. And in the midst of that, to begin to be suspicious of those in leadership who have not done what we want them to do, and that is solve all of our problems, take us into the promised land. And then personal ambition can easily be fortified with our rationalizations based on our disgruntledness. It seems like every year in Gutenberg, one way or another, this question gets asked, and that is revolution ever justified? And I don't know that this question, that this passage answers that question, but it does, I think, kind of touch on it. If I understand the biblical perspective correctly, everything that we recognize as authority in human society ultimately derives itself from God. And people who are in positions of authority have been granted that authority by God. Is it ever right to overthrow a government or remove someone from their position of authority by force? I think that there are times when that probably is justified. But there comes a point where someone has so violated their position that revolution becomes justified. But the older I get, the more conservative I get. And I look back at things that have happened over the course of history and struck by the fact that revolutions rarely change things significantly. Revolutions happen and a new government comes in that is really no better and oftentimes worse than the one that it replaced. So I am very conservative in that respect. But I think what this passage is helpful to see is that there's a tendency to see leaders as being more significant than they really are. And if we have any problems, to attribute those to the leader rather than identifying the true source of the problem. And in that respect, this passage is very interesting. They are not in the land of milk and honey. That's true. Why are they not in the land of milk and honey? Is it because Moses has not provided adequate leadership? No. It's because the people have been rebellious against God. It's not Moses' fault. It's their fault. But it's so easy to pass off the blame to someone who's in authority as being responsible for whatever ills we see around us. So I think this passage is a good reminder to us that when we think about what's wrong with society, that it's important that we keep things in perspective and that we not use someone as a scapegoat for those things. The only other thing I want to point out here is a kind of ironic situation here. If you'll recall, when God first came to Moses and said, I want you to go back to Egypt and lead my people out of Egypt, Moses said, nah, I'm not qualified. I stutter. And he also adds when he's talking, when he's negotiating with God, they won't accept me. And God's response was, well, I will give them signs. That's kind of interesting to me because God never reassured him that they will accept you. He just said, I'll give them signs. The fact is, God sent Moses into a situation where the very thing he feared happens time and time and time again. The Israelites, God did send the signs, but nevertheless, the people of Israel will not accept his God-given authority. And that keeps coming up. The very thing that he had feared, he has to face into and work his way through each and every time. And I find that very godlike. That there's what God was doing is not sparing him from his fears, but helping him face into those and work through those. And the very thing he feared happened. But God helped Moses work through that stuff. Okay, just a little time for any questions or comments.
You started out by talking kind of about parent-child relationship and kind of the drive of the parent is to kind of teach the child values. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, you were talking kind of about God needing to wipe out an entire generation of people whose values were kind of backwards. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of thinking about my own life and kind of the biblical narrative about, I mean, if I came from a wealthy family and things were really easy for me, I really wouldn't value the things that I value right now. Mm-hmm. And Jesus kind of talked about it being really difficult for the rich to inherit the kingdom of God. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of, if it's a man principle or a God principle about people kind of needing to go without or be kind of humbled for them to really kind of come to terms with what's valuable to God. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. There are a lot of things that can obscure from us the fact that we are dependent beings, that God created us to be dependent beings who depend on him for absolutely everything. And those things that obscure that fact are things like riches, power, any kind of wealth or privilege. All of those things can deceive us into thinking that, no, I've got things made to one extent or another. And that these things that I have are my security. They are the things that keep me going. They are the things that give me life. And those have to be stripped away from us. One way or another, those have to be stripped away from us in order for us to realize that we are truly dependent beings. We are dependent on God for absolutely everything. That's a very difficult lesson to learn, but a very important one.
But it seems almost, if we come from a position of luxury, that seems to be kind of hard written in our minds. And then if we are kind of abased, it's really difficult for us to kind of say, not long for the good old days.
Yes, absolutely.
And to the point, you know, where kind of, Jesus kind of said, you know, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man. And I'm wondering, And that just seems to be really true, doesn't it?
Right. I think that's true. And I think that what's happening with the people of Israel has an analogy in our own lives. And that is, there's a sense in which we always yearn for the days of our rebelliousness against God. There are ways in, there are thing, there's a legacy of that that will always be with us throughout this life. And we always struggle against it throughout this life. And that has to die.
How often can we view the Israelites' behavior as the breaking of a promise?
In what do you have in mind?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I asked about when they when it was time to go into the land, and they said, "Eat, you know, we're afraid." And it seemed at the time to me rather harsh for God to punish people for being afraid. I mean, that's self-preservation. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, didn't they somewhere along the line agree to this? It's this we will do. And when it came time to actually do what they'd agreed to do,
mm-hmm.
they broke their half of the promise.
Mm-hmm.
And so there seems to be a battle of characters. God just keeps keeping his promise. They just keep breaking theirs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that sometimes the unintentional sin is actually, it's not like they're walking up and kicking God in the shins and saying, "The hell with you." They're just saying, "Yeah, I know I made that promise when I felt like it, but now I don't feel like it."
Mm-hmm.
And that is a hideous
mm-hmm.
behavior
mm-hmm.
in God's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that could be a part of it. But with respect to the harshness of God's treatment of the people of Israel for not going into the promised land, I think God would make a distinction between fearfulness that is just part of us being human beings and a fearfulness that grows out of a mistrust of God himself. I mean, that was not just fearfulness, that was rebelliousness on the part of the people of Israel. Because God had promised them that he would be with them and make that possible. So what made that a scary situation was their mistrust of God. Caleb didn't have that same fear, and Joshua. So it was a fear that grew out of mistrust. I think if they were to have been just fearful and had gone to God and said, "We know you're telling us to go in there, but it sure looks scary to us," that's a different matter, I think, than to just say, "It looks scary to us, we're not going." I think those are different responses.
Is it possible that they longed to be a kept people rather than an independent, self-sufficient, "You make a mistake, you suffer for it, these will be your fields to tend"
yeah.
people?
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I mean...
Yeah, the way I think of it is we recognize the fact that we are dependent beings at one level or another. So we are going to be in servitude to something. That doesn't have quite the same ring to it as Bob Dylan's song, but you got to serve somebody. And that's very true. And the question is, who are we going to serve? Are we going to serve that which we were made to serve? Or are we going to serve that which gives us the goodies that we want? One more.
I don't have a problem with God, you know, choosing a people and then wiping people out within his own chosen people. I mean, we could all do a good if God came down and wiped one of us out. The thing is, I've always kind of pondered about, you know, you read the Old Testament, it's a bit jarring. I mean, Steve goes along, wakes up in the morning, kisses his wife goodbye, grumbles against God, and God takes him out. I mean, that's a little unnerving.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be fair then to say, it's not just that he was grumbling? I mean, the text says, you know, he grumbled, he did something stupid, didn't put up the tent right, and pow, you're burying the guy. But I mean, because for all intents and purposes, a lot of people marching through the desert, that's not, I mean, grumbling is going to be a hot commodity there. I mean,
right.
So I mean, it's not just that, you know, some guy's like, oh, man, there's sand in my soup, and God wipes him out. I mean, it's a little more. It's more of a Tower of Babel kind of a rebellion where this person is specifically actively rebelling against God out of a basic hatred in their heart, not just the fact that it sucks to be in the desert and I hate putting up tents, or how come I don't get to do that guy's job. It's ultimately like that's what the text says, but ultimately would you say or would you not say that it's just something deeper? It's something
right.
I mean, right. The one that always gets me is, of course, like, I mean, in regards to how much God knows our soul and how the people around us might not, is the guy who reaches out to stop the ark from
right.
falling, and David's
right.
just like, what the hell's your problem, God?
Right.
And God's just like, no, I'm sorry.
Right.
Taking that guy out. So, I mean, I still don't know the scenario, and I don't know the guy's heart, but I'm assuming God's a better judge of that guy than even David was, who was like right there when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My assumption is, yes, that God, who can read the hearts of man, that generally speaking, what he's perceiving here is not just a passing complaint or a passing grumble, but rather is a dissatisfaction that comes from the soul. That generally speaking, that's what we're dealing with here. But it doesn't seem to me that it's impossible, like in the case of the man who touches the ark as it's falling off the wagon, that he's absolutely innocent. And that God chose to zap him in that instance to make a point. I meant what I said, and that's just the way it is. But what's really important to understand here is these people dying is not their eternal fate. The eternal fate is a different issue. And the guy who touches the Ark of the Covenant, he may be in heaven as far as I know, even though he got punished for that particular action. So what happens to these people through their punishment here in this world isn't necessarily indicative of what their eternal destiny is.
Help me out, man. Help me out.
Hello?
Okay. Would you say that there's just some, but there must be something just inherently ingrained in our temporal nature it's hard to wrap your mind around that. I mean, to say, yes, this life is not the one that matters, it's this one that comes after. But still, God took somebody out here, like right now. Like, it still would be a little, it wouldn't be easy for me to go, oh yeah, that was right of God, and sure, that person could be innocent, but it's all okay. I mean, that's still a little weird. I mean, it's cool God to do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it,
right.
But God
right.
can do it.
Well, there are two or three things that God can do that we find difficult. It's a little weird, but I don't find it. I mean, he is, after all, God, and how he chooses to make his points is up to him. And it doesn't seem to me that it is inherently problematic that he would choose to use someone as an example of what of to say, don't do this, and I mean it, even if they are ultimately not rebellious against God. Okay, thanks.